The Midwest of the United States and the Middle East come together in the person of our next guest. Naomi Shihab Nye was born in St. Louis, right smack in the middle of America, but she's the daughter of a Palestinian man, a refugee, and she has spent a fair amount of time in the Middle East, among many other places. She's primarily a poet and visits Ashland tonight for an appearance at 7 at Ashland High School, brought in by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. Naomi Shihab Nye has been writing for a long time, with more than 30 books to her credit, either as poet or prose writer or as editor. She twice won the James Adams Book Award for Peace and Justice and has a pile of other awards and fellowships to her name. She served a 6-year term that ended about 2 years ago on the Board of Chancellors of the American Academy of Poets. We could go on and on and on. The resume alone could take about half an evening, but Naomi Shihab Nye, good to have you here on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It's great to be back in Ashland.
Been 11 years, I understand. You have been here before.
I know, and it only feels like 6 years because I like it here so much.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful place. And just hearing you right now with the weather, to be in a place where you can use the word valley so many times is very appealing to me. Where I live in San Antonio, Texas, you almost never hear anyone say the word valley.
No uplands in San Antonio.
No. Well, we have the hill country to the west, but nevertheless, you never hear anyone talk about a valley. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to hear.
San Antonio has been home for a long time, hasn't it?
Yes. My parents moved there when I was still a high school student. So I graduated from high school and went to college there.
So your parents had very, very different backgrounds. We talked about your father being a Palestinian refugee. How did they meet?
They were absolutely of different backgrounds. They met in Kansas, where neither of them had lived at all in the past. They had arrived in town about the same day. My mother was there for a very short stay, and my father was on a scholarship to go to college. And so they met, and they were, I think, stunned by sharing so many thoughts about the world, which were similar, even though their backgrounds were completely dissimilar. And they fell in love. It was one of those crazy love stories. In 3 months, they're married. And then within a year, I'm born. And so they had a long, long lives together. And they both valued reading. They both valued language. My father would become a newspaper journalist and my mother a Montessori school teacher. They loved communication of all kinds, and they were very open-minded, both of them.
I'm going to write yes next to this question right away. Were you read to a lot as a child?
Yes, absolutely read to, especially by our mother, because our father was more of the storytelling vernacular. And so he would talk to us, tell us these beautiful stories every night before bed, and our mother would read to us a lot.
Did your father talk frankly to you growing up about having to flee Palestine?
He was always frank about the story, and he was always hopeful as a refugee that Palestinian people and Jewish people were brothers and sisters and should be able to figure out a way to share that very small land that they were all, you know, leaning towards or living in. And he never lost that hope, Jeff, as long as he lived. His whole life, despite being a journalist and having to report on what many of us see as so much injustice in the region, he never lost his hope. He continued to remember his earliest days in Palestine, where he had many Jewish friends and where there wasn't a strong distinction made. People never said, you shouldn't be friends with that person because they're different from you or they have a different religion. You should be friends with everybody. And that was the world he had grown up in and the world he continued to believe in all his life. And of course, he had so many Jewish friends himself everywhere that he just never wanted to believe that the situation was irrevocable.
Okay, much more to talk about the Middle East and Palestine. I want to come back to some basic things about when you started writing yourself.
I started writing as a little child, started sharing my work right away. Was never shy to send poems to magazines, which I started doing when I was 7, and had the feeling that sending words out into the world, maybe you could make some friends. It was that simple. It was not a career dream. It was something as simple as like being a pen pal with the world.
Mm-hmm. Was there a career dream you had when you were that little and already writing?
No, I don't have a career. I mean, I never had.
To this day.
No, I never really thought about careers. I just thought about what you love to do in life.
Did you have early influences? Did you have people whose work made you say, I want to do that?
Yes. All the people I read and loved, whose work I loved as a child, people from Walt Whitman, Carl Sandburg, Emily Dickinson, Rabindranath Tagore, Arab writers my father would translate to us. You know, I loved hearing these people, children's books, Margaret Wise Brown, Robert Louis Stevenson. You know, I loved so many of the same people everybody grows up loving if you're lucky enough to have a relationship with a world of books. And so I felt all these people were my friends through their voices. And, you know, you want to model yourself, just like if you love sports, maybe you want to go out and shoot some baskets. Same with me. If you love reading, you want to write your own thoughts down.
So how do you construct your poetry? I'm curious always about process, and I want to know what decisions you make before you even put a word on paper, or are there decisions made before you put a word on paper or on screen?
I think it's very good to be a regular writer, to write in tiny increments, even if you don't have like full hours every day that you can give to your writing practice. But I try to write every day. I mean, I do write every day. I handwrite. I am very spontaneous in, you know, writing down whatever is immediate, whatever's been going on, a thought that just pops up. You know, you allow yourself to write anything, and then the crafting, the editing, the revision, that comes in afterwards. But I love all of that process, and I think it is important to keep the two parts sort of separate, to allow yourself to write things which seem silly or foolish, to write lists of questions, write from wherever you are, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and then work with it. And that's sort of how we live.
So don't try to push off anything. You think, I'm feeling grumpy today. I'm just going to put that aside and you know, write. You deal with what you got.
Well, I would write down the grumpiness. Mm-hmm. You know, what's that coming from? And what has stirred it up in you? And often you'll find out you feel better 5 minutes later. I mean, many people talk about the therapeutic aspect of participating in any art, that through expression you are able to move on and feel, you know, look at what you're experiencing differently. And I think it's true.
Naomi Shihab Nye, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, speaking at Ashland High School tonight at 7:30, brought in by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. We'll come back and talk more with Naomi and hear some of her poetry as read by her when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the well-known poet and prose writer and editor Naomi Shihab Nye. She is in Ashland for the second time in about a dozen years to speak tonight at Ashland High School at 7:30. And you can join the conversation here and now on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I was looking at some video clips of you online the other day to get ready for talking to you today, and I love the story you told at the new school in 2013 about meeting someone who said they never got poetry. And I'm sure you've heard that probably a few times over the years. And I can remember having the same conversation myself with people about poetry. It's like, oh, I like it when it rhymes. You know, people with offhand comments like that.
Right. Or people who feel that there is one coded message that everybody is supposed to be understanding. Uh-huh. The same coded message in a poem. In fact, I had this conversation in the airplane yesterday with my seatmate who was a very kind high school senior. Uh-huh. And he said, you know, I love poetry. I'm attracted to it. But I always feel like I'm not good enough for it.
Like I'm not getting it?
Yeah,
something?
I'm not. That there must be more there and I'm not getting it. And so we had this interesting conversation about that. And, you know, why did he feel that way? And I guess for me, I was always happy if I felt a chord or a harmony with a single image in a poem or a question or something that a poem would evoke in me. And I'd think, oh, I can understand that. That makes sense to me. I felt something similar. Maybe I was just a dimwit, but that would make me feel really happy. So I didn't feel as if I had to, you know, have full, total access to the writer's intentions.
Well, but that ultimately is what happens in a lot of writing. Do people expect more of poetry than they do of prose? I mean, people will be moved differently by a novel or a short story based on who they are, right?
I think a lot of it depends on which writers you're exposed to as a reader or listener, and who you carry with you, who is your special poet. Now, for me, my special poet of my lifetime was Oregon's great William Stafford. So because I started reading William Stafford, luckily, when I was 16 years old, and I would read anything I could related to him. You know, his style of participation in language and experience, I think, confirmed that we should be better listeners to ourselves, to our own lines, to our own images. We should pay attention. We should see how things connect. We should allow ourselves to be surprised. So, you know, I never had a feeling after reading William Stafford all these years that that I was alone as a writer. You know, he's befriended so many readers over the years. And when you have that sense of connection to someone's work, you don't have to be able to claim you could paraphrase every single sentence they ever wrote. I mean, that's not what poetry wants to do. You know, I've often said to kids, when you go to a ballet, do you go outside from the ballet and stand on the sidewalk and say, now, what did that really mean? No, you don't. You just think, wow, that was beautiful. I want to kick my legs more. I want to turn around and twirl more. I want to love my body more, you know? So I think people need to feel that way about poetry too.
You mentioned William Stafford, who said of you, of your work, her poems combine transcendent liveliness and sparkle, along with warmth and human insight. She's a champion of the literature of encouragement and heart. Reading her work enhances life. Wow. How did you get a bicycle helmet on after hearing that?
Well, that was so nice and generous of him, but that's the kind of person he was. He was very encouraging to others, and I was grateful that he would even take the time to say anything to me or about my work. That was so kind.
Why don't we hear some of your work? Because we've been talking about it. So of this pile that I brought in, we have Blood, we have Famous, we have Dusk. I want to hold Hello Palestine back just a little bit here.
Okay.
Any of these appeal to you?
Sure. I would love to read Dusk and at Mother Teresa's.
Okay.
Okay, so Dusk comes from a book called Transfer. Where is the name no one answered to, gone off to live by itself, beneath the pine trees, separating houses, without a friend or a bed, without a father to tell it stories? How hard was the path it walked on, all those years belonging to none of our struggles, drifting under the calendar page, elusive as residue, when someone said, how have you been? It was strangely that name that tried to answer.
That is Dusk by Naomi Shihab Nye, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. And you also wanted to read At Mother Teresa's.
Yes. Finally, there are enough people to hug. A room of two-year-olds with raised arms. We swing them into the air. Their grins are windows in a city of crumbling walls. One girl stays in the corner, crouched over her shoes. Hard to keep shoes in this world. People steal them. They walk away. Her flaming hair is a house she lives in all alone. When I touch it, she looks up, suspicious, then lifts a stub of chalk from her shoe, makes three jagged lines on the floor. Can I read? I nod rapidly, imagining, love me, yes. But she is too alone to believe it. Her face closes. I will never guess.
That one is called At Mother Teresa's. Did this actually happen in Calcutta?
It did. It happened in Calcutta. My husband and I had visited Mother Teresa's child care, well, the orphanage. Mm-hmm. And at the time, no children were being adopted by Americans. But there was a Belgian couple, I remember, who were hoping to adopt a two-year-old. And somehow we had met them in the street outside the orphanage. And we ended up part of their entourage going in as they were going to pass through this room of two-year-olds and start looking. I mean, it just seemed overwhelming to me. How could you see all these little two-year-olds with their arms held up to you? How could you pick one? What would you do? And so I was almost glad that Americans were not allowed to adopt children there. Mother Teresa was mad at the United States at that time.
Oh, I remember.
Yes. Yeah. And but I was relieved because I thought if we were allowed, we'd probably go home with 12 children today. I don't know how you could even come in here and leave them with them wanting to hug you so much. And I was very haunted by the saddest little girl in the room, the one who did not come forward to greet the visitors, and the one who looked so suspicious and so isolated.
Did you feel like she'd given up?
I felt as if her story, whatever it was, and of course you don't know any of their stories when you go into that room. The nuns are there fluttering around, you know, trying to connect you to the children and trying to bring the children over to play with you for a minute. But you don't know their stories. And so you see a little child and you think, what have you witnessed before this this young age that makes you so alone in the corner that, you know, I thought of her for years. And the Dusk poem, looking at it here, it haunts me because it was written after a reunion with about 9 kids that I had played with in Ferguson, Missouri, which was the first community I lived in as a child.
Wow.
And we had gotten together for a kind of unexpected reunion. And we had sat under the same trees where we played as children together. And we had shared stories. Like, questions we asked each other were things like, well, what's something that happened in your home as a child that you think the rest of us didn't know about? You know, we shared them. And I remember being very haunted by how we all felt we had been very close friends, and yet we each carried like our own parcel of secrets. And we each remembered each other's parents in ways that other people didn't expect.
And in ways different from how we remember our own parents.
Exactly, in ways different. And then, so thinking like we all have secret names, where's the name no one answered to? And then we had these pine trees and you know, we had the person whose father had left the family. We were always dreaming he was going to come back. And so just that sense of every human story and its light and its shadows.
I've noticed in talking to many writers over the years that the good poets and the good prose writers, essayists in particular, have a lot of attention to detail. They notice things. I mean, small things that can seem huge when they are rendered in a poem. But I'm curious to know about how you can see things like the children at the orphanage and still stay open to experiences and not just feel like, oh, my God, there's so much sadness in the world.
Well, you know, I think going away from that day and thinking about those children for years. I mean, every time I've gone back to India, I think of those children. I think I could be passing them. They could be, you know, right here in the restaurant next to me, one of those children that I met years ago. I think details are what make the world go round. That's how we connect to our lives. We each are granted parcels of details every day. How will you relate to them? How will you carry them? What will you do with them? Will you value them? And will you respect someone else's details? When people are disrespected in the world, as so many people are, you feel as if their own details are not being acknowledged. And I just think it's part of our job as human beings to value the little things that we're given, you know, the stuff of life.
Naomi Shihab Nye is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a well-known poet, prose writer, editor, more than 30 books to her credit. Speaking at Ashland High School tonight at 7:30, brought to town once again by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange and join the conversation, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we mentioned the fact that you were born in St. Louis, did a lot of growing up in Texas, but you also did go to high school at least part of the time in Jerusalem.
Yes,
and also in Ramallah in the West Bank.
Yes, I went to 2 different high schools there, and then I would go back many times because my Palestinian grandmother lived to be 106 years old.
Wow.
So we were going back to visit her. In fact, our own son, my son, got to know her. When I took him to meet her, he was 5. She was 105. So that was a pretty special day or week or 2 weeks or month or whatever we stayed. So going back to the Middle East over the years, it's been a very important place in my family history and my life. And I am traumatized by how little many Americans know about things in the Middle East, and I feel very saddened when there's a kind of blanket insult cast across the Middle East or all people of Muslim faith or anybody of any region in the world, you know, where you're not respecting their details when you do that, and you're not respecting their essential humanity. And so it's very important to me to talk about just common human life in the Middle East.
You talked about how your father, who was a Palestinian refugee himself, I assume he left around the time the State of Israel was born.
He left a couple of years later, right. His family lost their home in Jerusalem. They lost everything. Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
But he always had this belief that Arabs and Jews were brothers.
Well, he did. He always had that, and he kept it all his life.
And had some hope, I'm sure, for a resolution of what's going on in the Middle East. And for you now, following in his footsteps, does it feel like peace in the Middle East is a mirage?
Well, you know, I think big power makes it very difficult. I think weapons make things much more difficult. I believe in all of the grassroots organizations, whether educational places like the hand-in-hand schools or initiatives like Seeds of Peace or Nevi Shalom, all of the wonderful things, Creativity for Peace, which is a girls' camp in New Mexico. There's so many great efforts and initiatives to bring people together. The Parents Circle, the bereaved parents who've lost children, who have their own organization, Palestinians and Israeli Jews together, working for peace. You know, we don't get to hear a lot about these people, Jeff, and they're doing such important good work. I feel like they deserve as much commentary as what the politicians bandy about when they have their, you know, tea parties. Let's hear about what real people on the ground are saying and doing together. And I continue to have hope because I know about all these people and I know them personally, many of them. And how could you give up hope entirely? There is a professor of science out of Bethlehem who has a wonderful newsletter who continues to believe that education and scientific projects, like digging in the ground together and learning how to have a relationship with the earth together, could be one thing that could save everybody. You know, all the good work, why is it always focused on division and weapons and negativity? It could be fixed, but people will have to give something up. And I think that notion of chosenness is something that really has to go. And everybody acknowledges that, who has a kind of, I don't know, ethical background of any kind. So let's do it. Why wait? So much sadness over so many years. You know, I have so many Jewish friends in the United States and elsewhere, and we always talk about how much fun a country could be that was shared in by Jews and Palestinians together. It could be an incredible place because they all have such talents.
Indeed. Would you mind reading Hello, Palestine, which is actually printed in the Jefferson Journal? In this
so this
edition.
Was for my father when he died. Hello, Palestine. In the hours after you died, all the pain went out of your face. Whole governments relaxed in your jawline. How long had you been away from the place you loved best? Every minute was too much. Each year's bundle of horror stories, more trees chopped, homes demolished, people gone crazy. You'd turn your face away from the screen. At the end, you spoke to your own blood, filtering through a machine. We'll get there again, friend. When you died, your long frustration zipped its case closed. Everyone in a body is chosen for trouble and bliss. At least nothing got amputated, I said, and the nurses looked quizzical. Well, if only you had seen his country.
Wow, that is Hello, Palestine, from Naomi Shihab Nye, whose father was a Palestinian refugee, and she'll be talking in Ashland tonight at 7:30 at Ashland High School. The economy of words that you use is impressive. There's nothing really directly said in there so much as alluded to, and yet so much information is conveyed with very plain words.
Thank you. I like plain words. I think I share with Carl Sandburg sometimes a little bit of a suspicion of too many adjectives. And people love adjectives. But I think if you can kind of keep the little
nice,
engine
thick,
of
meaty
the
adjectives,
poem going with nouns and verbs and make the parallels or metaphors you need to make, I think sometimes it'll serve you better as a writer. But, I think writing helps us think. And when I sit down to work on poems every day, I feel as if I'm assisting the process, my mindful process of what are you experiencing? What are you remembering? How do we live? How do we think? And we need clarity. You know, we don't like it when our minds feel confused and befuddled by muchness, by too much, and by so many things we can't solve. We need to look at the details which sustain us. And for me that day, just being able to think in a certain way, you know, got me through the hardest day of my life. And I did stay with his body the whole day. I asked the hospital to give me that. Mm-hmm. And it was a very important day just to be there alone with his body and talk to him.
And a very critical time for you, it sounds like, to be able to
it was
to
a critical him, time yeah. and just to feel the calming of mm-hmm. being with him and kind of acknowledging things that had been important to him all his life and you know, kind of agreeing or hoping to carry on his voice in some way, if I could, or to remind people of his voice. Or
Naomi Shihab Nye, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Hello, Palestine, the poem she just read about her father in the hospital dying years ago. We'll come back and talk more with Naomi and hear more of her poetry and talk about her appearance tonight at Ashland High School. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Naomi Shihab Nye, who lives in Texas, but can count a lot of other places in the world as having been visited or having been from. She actually went to high school in Ramallah and Jerusalem at different times, in addition to her time in Texas. She is the daughter of a Palestinian refugee and has been filling books with her thoughts for years and years now, up to 30 books now in poetry and prose, and as an editor as well. And she'll be appearing tonight at Ashland High School at 7:30, brought in by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. You can join us now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from a listener, Joy and Talent, who writes, "It seems like bad poetry," she uses quotes, "is the most rampant type by how often the phrase is uttered. What does that even mean? Isn't all art subjective?"
Well, I don't know who's uttering bad poetry, but I don't think in terms of bad poetry. I mean, you don't have to like every poem equally in the world, and you won't. But what is bad poetry? Yeah, I agree. It's subjective. Yes, I agree with you. And a poem that you might feel, well, this poem is bad. It's cluttered. It doesn't do anything for me. It doesn't feel fresh. For someone else, might really lift them up. So who knows?
My own memory of trying to compare notes with people on poetry, you know, the kind of thing where like, well, it happens with everything, though, doesn't it? It's like, I love this song. I hate this song. Your
right.
friend will say to you. But I remember in particular at the Bill Clinton inauguration and the poetry of Maya Angelou.
Yes.
The Rock.
Yes.
Which I heard it on the radio and was going, wow, that's an amazing poem.
I loved
And I got
her.
The text of it later in the day and I gave it to a friend and said, look, isn't this cool? And she went, yeah, I like poems that rhyme.
Well, she probably had only been exposed to poems that rhyme. And, you know, I like sound devices as well. I love Macklemore. I love his sound obsessions and his ability to weave really meaningful content in with all the rhyme he uses. But it's not an absolute necessity. You know, why can't we like many kinds of poems? We could like many kinds and hopefully we do, just like we don't like only one food.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Why don't you grab the headphones? We have a phone call for you as well.
Okay.
So we're going to go to Thomas in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. You're on with Naomi Shihab Nye.
Hi, Thomas.
Yes. Hello. I think your poetry is very beautiful, and I had it teared me up, especially your poem about your father and also Mother Teresa. I was wondering, and while I was waiting, I made up my mind I'm going to come and listen to you no matter whether or not, but I'm a disabled retired physician and I'm working now on nonfiction books. I'm just finishing up one on chronic pain and I'm also starting one on addiction evaluation and treatment. And my question was whether or not a nonfiction writer would benefit from your presentation tonight.
Well, that's a good question. Thanks for that, Thomas. Good to hear from you.
Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you.
And I wish you well on your projects. Those sound like very, very important subjects, and I'm so glad you're writing them. And I really don't see strong divisions between genres of writing. You know, I think there's poetry in nonfiction, there's poetry in prose. I like writing poems that contain a lot of nonfictional elements as well. So I think it's all part of, you know, one big family. And I would hope that you might be encouraged or fortified by something you might hear tonight. Of course, I can't promise you that, but I would hope. So please come if you can, and I'd love to meet you. And I wish you well on your work.
How prepared a text do you have for a talk like you're planning tonight?
I don't have a prepared text. I have ideas. I have something I want to tell about my last visit to Ashland that has marked me all these years in a very positive way. I've talked about what happened at the high school many places. And so I should bring it up here tonight for anyone who wasn't there and how great it was. And So I make notes and like a little outline sketch, but it's a lot depends upon the mood I feel in the room and the interaction with the audience and like which things I actually choose to read and how many brand new things that I've never read before I might read or older things, hopefully a mixture of those.
I wanted to ask about some of the other work you did with the issues of Palestinians and Arabs. And you did write a young adult novel called Habibi.
Yes.
What can you tell us about that?
I did. I didn't think I could write something that long, although it's a young adult novel, so it's not the longest novel in the world. But my beautiful editor, Virginia Duncan, encouraged me to. And I'm glad I did because I think probably I don't like count up my numbers of sold books. But I think probably it's the book of mine that's gotten around the most. It's certainly been translated into the most languages. And it's a book of hope and a book of friendship and a book of bridge building. But it also tries to show young people as carriers of idealism. And both the Arab American girl in the book, who is sort of like me, but not me, and the Israeli boy in the book are very hopeful individuals, and they don't want to repeat mistakes their ancestors have made. They would like to make, as they say, a new story and a better story. So I'm glad the book has gotten around. It's still in print. And I was able to write it, and I've written two or three more novels since then, and I'm working on another one. So it was something I thought I couldn't do that someone else encouraged me to do. And by the way, last night I heard that James Anderson lives in Ashland, and he is the first person who ever invited a full-length poetry manuscript from me, so I'd like to thank him publicly. And that was so many years ago, and he had just read some of my poems in chapbooks, and he was the editor at Brighton Bush Books in Oregon then.
Mm-hmm.
So my first full-length book was published in Oregon. So I have a great debt to the state of Oregon, not only because of William Stafford, but James Anderson and all the great people of this state and all the things that have happened here.
How far outside your comfort zone did writing a novel take you?
Well, it was hard because I think poets are, we don't really like, as William Stafford used to say, we don't like much to happen.
Mm-hmm.
We don't care about plot. We'd rather, you know, sit and stare at things and sit and think about things. But for there to be plot, you know, like if these people have a car, when did they get the car? We haven't met the car. What kind of car is it? Where is it? You know, all that sort of dull life stuff has to be included in a novel. You know, they can't suddenly be just on a bus. Well, when did they get on it? Why are they on it? So I had to deal with those ramifications of, you know, literal narratives thread. And I think that's a little harder for a poet sometimes.
It's like having to go and buy groceries and clean the house and things like that.
Yeah. I love buying groceries and cleaning the house, by the way. I can handle that narrative thread. But yeah, it was a challenge. And I do a lot of rewriting. On Habibi, I think I rewrote it 4 or 5 times. And on The Turtle of Oman, which is my most recent novel for elementary kids, I rewrote it 13 times, I'm proud to say. And elementary students are shocked when they hear that.
Really?
They think, you could write something that many times? You're that old? And it took you that many drafts to make a book? And I'm proud to say, yes, it did.
So about the poetry, though, I mean, how many drafts of do you go through on poems?
Well, many drafts. You know, I'm always revising and slashing and adding and rearranging. And sometimes even after a poem is published, you keep changing it a little bit. And when you read it, you don't read it exactly the way it appears on the page sometimes. So, you know, I think everything is constantly in a state of revision.
I put one in front of you here. This is Famous, isn't it?
Yes, and the poem Famous was written in response to a very popular question that kids used to ask me, especially when I was very young and I would go into their school libraries to speak to them, and they would raise their hands first question and say, "Are you famous?" And I was perplexed. Like, what did they even mean by that word? I would say things like, "No, I'm your neighbor. I live down the block. Let's talk about writing." And then they would look like, "Oh, push off. She's not famous. We're not going to listen." And they would turn their heads away. And so then I started asking them, "What does that word even mean to you?" And then I would say things like, "Well, everything is famous if you notice it." And they would look baffled. And so then I decided I'll write a poem. And anytime anyone asks that, I'll just read it to them. So this was the poem, and it recently became its own picture book, illustrated by Lisa DeSimone. The river is famous to the fish. The loud voice is famous to silence, which knew it would inherit the earth before anybody said so. The cat sleeping on the fence is famous to the birds, watching him from the birdhouse. The tear is famous, briefly, to the cheek. The idea you carry close to your bosom is famous to your bosom. The boot is famous to the earth, more famous than the dress shoe, which is famous only to floors. The bent photograph is famous to the one who carries it, and not at all famous to the one who is pictured. I want to be famous to shuffling men who smile while crossing streets, sticky children in grocery lines, famous as the one who smiled back. I want to be famous in the way a pulley is famous or a buttonhole, not because it did anything spectacular, but because it never forgot what it could do.
Famous, as read by its creator, Naomi Shihab Nye. It's interesting. It really jumped out because you so seldom do use adjectives, as you said. When you use one, it really sticks with you. Sticky.
Sticky.
Sticky children in grocery lines.
They're always in grocery lines, those sticky children eating something that they've gotten out of their mother's cart. Yeah. And it's been fun to read that poem in response to the question, but I don't think kids ask it so much anymore because, I don't know, we're living in a different age, the internet age.
Oh, because everybody's famous now?
I don't know, I guess.
I'm a big deal on the internet,
goodness.
That kind of thing.
I guess, I don't know. But I'm glad. I mean, I'm glad the word has taken maybe less of a meaning or more of a meaning. I don't know what.
Has the world that you inhabit with the work you do, has your process or how you deliver it changed at all because of the fact that everybody can put pretty much everything they're thinking out on the internet? Instantly.
Well, I think we have more to filter through, and you have to make very deliberate decisions about how much time you're going to give to your internet life, your browsing around navigation. I do not use social media. I just don't know where that would fit in. Like, what, at 1 a.m.? When would people have time to do that?
Some people do it
overnight,
I'm told.
My life has always felt like really pleasantly full. I still like letters in the mail. I've always wanted to keep things simple. So although I do use the internet, like say to look up a musician I hadn't heard of before or look up some person or, you know, read some news sometimes, I don't use it probably as much as some people do. And we all have to decide, do we still want to have a life with real text on a page? Do we still want to handwrite and make those choices?
Would you say you're a voracious reader of other people's work? It seems like you can rattle off so many names so quickly.
Absolutely voracious. And I think we all should be. And I'm very grateful to Chautauqua Poets and Writers series for having a commitment to sharing voices with community at large, like many people in the community, with young people, with older people. You know, that is a beautiful thing when a community shares in a voice and or shares books we've read, poems we've read. You know, it connects us. And I think we are living in particularly disconnected feeling times. And I think that sharing literature, sharing voices which matter to us may take on new meaning in coming days.
Things we might be able to agree on.
Yeah. Things that we might say, hey, have you read Juan Felipe Herrera? Read his stories about growing up in a migrant worker family in California. And maybe you'll think about those immigrants in the news in a slightly different way.
Coming back to the issue of observation and the powers of observation of a poet, and what I didn't apply there was the question about how important it is to observe without judging.
Right. You know, I recently read an amazing quote in an obituary in San Antonio. It was of a man I had never heard of who had worked in the mental health field, a doctor. And his son said about him, he knew how much discipline it takes to stay open-minded. And I thought, wow, that's interesting to connect those two things, being open-minded, which some people might see as a sort of willy-nilly position in the world, and discipline. To remain open-minded takes discipline. So I think that we need to keep reminding ourselves that we can't take certain things for granted. You know, the respect for one another's voices is something I grew up with. You know, I was lucky enough to have teachers who said, listen to all, read all these people, read all these voices, stay awake, and find the ones that matter most to you. And I think we need to keep doing that, even though the ways of finding the voices might be a little different.
I've learned to not ask people anymore what their favorite project is, because they always say, come on, it's like picking out a favorite kid. But I will ask this, is there something you haven't done yet that you're still itching to do? Some unresolved, like, oh, I always planned to do that and never got to it.
Well, I haven't done so many things, and I admire everyone else who does those things, whatever they might be. But not really. I feel, you know, every day is an enormous pleasure writing and still feeling as if you're a young kid discovering the world. And so I can't really think of something.
Even the titles of your works are fun to relate. Like, I'll ask you three times, are you okay? And I feel a little jumpy around you. So all kinds of great work from the pen, the keyboard, however she does it. Naomi Shihab Nye. She'll be at Ashland High School tonight at 7:30, brought in by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. And it's been a pleasure to get to know you here.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I really appreciate our conversation.
Me too. Take care. Thank you.